Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a working film and TV editor. For the last 9 years, I've done over 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris FX products for nearly 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we speak to the editors of Gran Turismo, Colby Parker Jr., ACE, Austin Daines, and co-editor Eric Friedenberg. Colby's been on Art of the Cut before for his work on Mile 22. Colby was nominated for an Ace Eddie for his work on Ant-Man. His other work includes Patriot's Day, Deepwater Horizon, Lone Survivor, and Battleship. Austin has edited the feature film Demonic and the Travis Scott documentary Look Mom, I Can Fly. Eric has cut features including Kandahar and documentaries including The World of Thinking. He's also cut TV including 30 for 30, 911, Unsolved Mysteries, and Chef's Table. And he was an editor on the GT Academy TV series. Before I hop into our discussion with Colby, Austin, and Eric, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bays as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for Mac OS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for more than 20 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Colby Parker Jr., ACE, Austin Daines, and Eric Friedenberg on editing Gran Turismo.
Hi, it's Colby Parker Jr.
Great. Hi, this is Austin Daines.
Still am Eric Friedenberg.
Did you get a little toy box, a little tool chest of great racing sounds when you started this that you could use when you were doing your initial cut?
No, yeah, we definitely got a sound package at the very beginning. We had Charles Deanon on the film, who is really profound in commercials, and Neil has worked with him in the past, and he gave us a sound package to work from. That wasn't for the whole film. I think we were using basically the same car sounds for all the races. We had three different sets of cars for each race, and especially the car that sounded nothing like what it ended up sounding like was our LMP2s in the Le Mans race. So once we finally like got through the director's cut and started getting into the mix, when we actually got the LMP2s recorded, it was really special to hear. We had a lot of help from Connor, our first assistant, in doing the sound design, at least for the sequences I was involved in. He was stellar with sound design. So I think the intent was there and maintained throughout the whole process, but it just sounded beefier and had that really pro touch once we got the sounds from Charles and also from Bo Borders, our sound effects mixer, and Kevin O'Connell, our other mixer.
In the races, there's some great rhythmic editing of longer shots. You know, obviously they're going down a straightaway or coming around a corner or something, but then there are these beautifully rhythmic, maybe 8-frame cuts. I don't even know what they are. Did you cut that stuff with sound when you were cutting the visuals, or did you cut on mute when you were doing those racing sequences with the great sound design?
All that is done with sound. Maybe internally before we present, we'll put the cuts together. But as far as presenting and trying to get those past Neil for approval, we always have sound design. We always try to make things sound as professional as possible. There's no such thing as presenting a rough cut anymore. If you want something to live, you have to sell it. Just having done a lot of sports films and working with someone like Pete Berg, who really reacts well to cuts like that. Kind of learned the process of doing that rhythmic editing, where you can't do it for too long either, because, you know, my audience will get desensitized. So it's about pacing and a little shot of adrenaline, and then let the audience catch up.
Bo Borders is a race car driver himself, recreationally, and super into it. And they went out and recorded a bunch. And there was some stuff that they put in later in the mix, like that was just extremely accurate downshifts as we're coming into a corner when they're braking. Really specific stuff that I think helps a lot, just selling the verisimilitude of the racing sequences. And then also they sent us this package of like stylized sound effects. They're in the opposite end of the spectrum, that were these sort of like whoosh bang with an engine growl things that we ended up using a lot for like the freeze frames. And so I thought it ended up being this really cool, like hyper stylized in moments and then super realistic in others.
I can't articulate it, so it'd be great for Eric to explain. What we've started doing on the last couple of films is dedicated a few tracks that Eric would put a lot of these whoosh bangs on. I call them R-Taz. What would you call the D-Verb tracks that we dedicate?
It's called something Taz. They're track inserts in the Avid, and I just put different decays of D-Verb, of long reverb. I actually found out they hate them on the mix stage, and they would curse me out because when you press stop, they keep ringing out, and one of them is like a minute long, so I think they were losing their minds. But yeah,
one of them is named Eric Long, and so they're like, "You're Eric."
Yeah, they hate it
when they put the name to the R-Tash track.
It's a quick and easy to manipulate way to add ring outs and reverb and style that we use all the time, both for music and sound effects.
It was really huge for us, especially for me, because this is like the first film in Avid that I've worked in. I come from Premiere. And so when I came into the project, they had this already set up and I used it all the time, like in every sequence. I was like, okay, I'm sold. This is a wonderful way to work.
It's allowing you to add an effect, not to just to a clip in the track, but to the entire track so that it rings past the end of the clip. I want to get back to the rhythm thing. When any of you are cutting those sequences with just real nice rhythm, you know, it's like gear shifts and foot pedals and inside shot of the engine for a few frames. When you're initially laying that and building that rhythm, do you have any sound at all?
The first pass, I'll probably do it without sound, especially on a scene like this, and kind of get the picture working well. And then I usually don't have help from assistants doing sound design. I'm like very particular, but Connor was so talented with it. I would just pass it to Connor and he would take a pass with the sound and we'd talk about it and then he'd give it back to me and then I would adjust. So it was kind of like this dance. He would do a pass of the sound. I'd get it and kind of look at it refreshed and like, okay, well, maybe this shot I need to hold longer. Or, you know what, this is not holding the attention properly. So it was definitely a dance with sound and those quick gear shifts. Once I added sound to those moments, sometimes I would revisit and make it even punchier. But one term that I've learned on this project from Colby and Eric is...
The burst cut?
The burst cut.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah. We kept on talking about the burst cut, and those were really nice to add some quick adrenaline into a moment or a scene.
Yeah, to echo that, this started from Pete Berg, who would always say triple cut it, and then we termed it a burst cut. There's something about the boom, 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 you know, the triple cut, or as I call it now, my cubist editing, where to that note, very rhythmic. And that's actually, a lot of times I'll do a cut like that and ask Eric for help with the sound, because he's extremely talented with that. And he always seems to elevate my cut when I ask Eric to help me with a little audio on some of these burst cuts. It's definitely a rhythmic trick that I find always works.
To geek out on that further, do you find that in those little burst cuts that those three cuts are the same length or slightly different? Are they all
Was I right at about 8 frames, or are they a little longer than that?
8 frames is the default for me. On a wipe, on an edge wipe, or anything I do is usually 8 frames is the default. And I stole that actually from Dan Leventhal, peeking in on his timeline. But each beast is its own animal, because I found that when I try and redo it, I'm like, why doesn't it work? And so the footage has to speak to you, and you can see where it works. But it is usually 2 quick cuts, and then the third cut is a little more elongated. So it's sort of a left-right combo, and then a few ducks and slips.
A big punch.
Yeah.
Boom. Yeah, got it.
Kind of gave away the secret sauce with that.
Oh, I know.
A little extra third cut. I'm going to have to steal that. It's always a feel thing for me, so I'm happy that you broke it down.
I've worked with multiple editors before, and you're like, how did they pull that off? And you go look at their timeline. Okay, I see what it is. I see it. Okay, two even at 8 frames, and then another at about 12. Okay, I see why that works. And it might not work for you the next time, but at least it gives you an idea of how they're pulling something off.
Just to the question about cutting with or without sound, I listen to this pod all the time, and I'm always baffled and amazed when I hear editors talk about cutting an entire film without music or sound. It's a discipline that eludes me. And I think I can never, especially for these like action sequences, I can't imagine knowing how it feels without some kind of music and sound where it's going to be, you know? And we also have the luxury of, on something like this with really good production audio tracks married into the Avid, so it wasn't really that hard. I mean, they obviously not what we ended up using. If we needed an engine rev or something, it was pretty easy to find something that was presentable just to be able to like feel it.
I wouldn't have thought the production sound was as good. I mean, I'm not saying anything about the production recordists, but just with, you know, oh, you're in a moving race car. Like, how good can the production sound be?
There are moments where you're trying to dig out what they're saying in the race car, and you're like, I have no idea.
To Neil's credit, he shot the dialogue while they're actually in a race car. So it's pretty loud. It also, I think, makes it really cool, because especially the drivers are really struggling in a way that you can't really fake.
In the early Academy footage, by Academy, for those who haven't seen the film, they bring them in to actually learn how to drive race cars, and they called it the Academy. In that footage, there's an interesting maybe time compression or almost a montage where David Harbour's character gets into a helicopter to watch the racers. He's up there for a while, and then it goes away from the racers, and it comes back and into the helicopter. You know, the helicopter is there again. It's not something that threw me, but it's something that I noticed, like, oh, was that multiple scenes that got compressed into a smaller time frame, or was it scripted like that?
It's conflating a bunch of different scenes. It's a reality show based on a true reality show. So, and Neil really shot it well. So basically we had a whole reality show to edit. So then what happens is we edit all the scenes. Everyone usually will have a scene within that, because we're sort of next man up mantra as the scenes come in. And then once it goes into a reel, it's like it happened to be that reel landed, was a reel I was working on. And we just start conflating the scenes, and you just shave it and whittle it down to the bone to see what you could get away with, because it was a sequence that was 45 minutes during, you know, when the editor's cut's done and Neil's like, let's cut this down. And then you just, to preserve different scenes, you just start conflating it. And then, you know, audiences nowadays, you know, are able to process things, and you can get away with truncating these scenes down and exposition still landing. As long as the pieces are in there, I think people store a bit of it, and our audiences are sophisticated enough to get it. And so obviously those are, you know, everything in the helicopter shot as one big chunk, and then we move it around and turn it into a montage and just do the time jumps and just see what we could get away with. And then speaking to Eric, who has done a lot of docuseries stuff, even when I watch him work, I learned so much as far as his talent is really able to make a story out of footage that wasn't meant to be a story. He's very analytical. And so sometimes when I show scenes or bounce scenes off him, he'll be like, this will have to be next in the story. I'm like, well, it wasn't shot like that. He's like, yes, but this is how the story should be told. And you kind of make up stuff or justify certain orders of scenes or sequences to tell help tell the story.
And I noticed the same thing. It's not just the helicopter. It's also like the he takes them out running on the track. And so the entire group is out running and they're out running for a while and a kid's throwing up and then they go away and they're in a race car and then they come back and they're running again. You know, it's just a way to show, right, that they keep doing the same thing over and over again. And
yeah,
like you said, a compression of time. And also,
if I may, I'd give Colby a ton of credit on that scene because he cut it and recut it so many different times and so many different ways. And from the very beginning, we had that like half hour, 40 minute academy sequence with each setup as its own scene. I remember he would look at it all and just be like, this is going to be 6 minutes tops. Hopefully it's like one hot piece of music. It's a montage. And he would like pace around and be like, he's in the chopper, then he's over there. And then when he's back in the chopper, you know, his like the cubist approach to the burst cut applies also to a montage where it doesn't matter if it doesn't actually make sense in some ways. It's the feeling and the audience will put it together and it actually feels better if you're bouncing around, you know.
Yeah, the nonlinear approach makes the time go by quicker, I find.
Also, the finding the music is super key. And I want to give a shout out to Colby's son, Liam, who found a couple of the tracks that we used in that scene. And he's like a cool 23-year-old. And it really helps because he's sort of is that demo. He's like one of those kids. And I think he found like three of those music cues that are just awesome.
Now I got to pay him, Eric. Thanks.
Is he going to put it on his IMDb page as uncredited music supervisor or something?
Yeah.
Colby and I were just talking about the Oppenheimer team. They did the same thing in Oppenheimer with when they went to go track down all the scientists and recruit all the scientists. They would be with one scientist and then they would go off to find the next scientist. And then the next scene would be back with the previous scientist at a different moment. So, you know, I think that's a common thing to do in editing, but it gives it a great pace, right? Because you're not stuck in the same part of the story for so long and then move bum, 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 bum down the path. You're jumping back and forth. I think it adds some energy. I love it. The training montages, you know, the Rocky thing of like, we've got to show them training. But that's intercut. So did you find that there was a method to the madness? I'm assuming it wasn't scripted. It sounds like things got compressed.
It's kind of a trailer. It feels like you're just cutting a trailer for one of these reality shows. And then you want to start seeing people get eliminated and just tell the story. A lot of people definitely pointed out in earlier cuts, it wasn't as linear as the final product. And people were like, well, you know, why was this guy eliminated and when was she eliminated? So I had to kind of streamline it towards the end and start telling the story of people getting eliminated. And so then we actually started to go a little bit more linear towards the end. But I was like, this that can get boring and we don't need to harp on this. All right, when people get eliminated, I'm going to discipline myself to make this in 30 seconds and get everybody eliminated. And then, you know, I just kind of give myself a few rules to follow by and just, I'm like, let's just get through these people getting eliminated. It's not that big a deal. It's not advancing the story per se. Then I just kind of fall back on my music video experience and try and literally get shots that look super cool and just keep it moving and find good music.
I also give Neil a lot of credit in that I noticed that like he responded really well to these sequences early on where we'd taken a lot of liberties and it wasn't exactly as scripted. And he loved the verging on chaos beats. And I would expect him to be like, well, what about this line of dialogue or whatever? And he'd just be like, that was rad. You know, can you make it radder?
And you do that even in your editor's cut? You would, or was it further down?
It's death to bore the director or whoever we're presenting, if it's producers early cuts. So maybe I learned this from Pete Berg, but I try and really advance the story as fast as possible and tell the story in the quickest way possible and sort of the most subversive way as well. I want the director to be like, all right, you've gone too far, pull back. I never wanted to say like, make this cooler or make this crazier. It's got to move, man. You know, I always, when they tell me, all right, let's slow this down a bit, tell the story more. It's like, okay, then I can do that. That's no problem. So that's sort of my goal.
We always cut a version of each scene that's all the dialogue as scripted. So like Colby always says, like, we have that. If we need to make it go back to that, we have it. But let's like put a foot forward. And I think Austin also has like a ton of polish, which I think, if I'm surmising, it comes from commercials and being so tight in 30 seconds. So his scenes always came out of the oven really cooked already. There was not like, oh, we're gonna massage this for and change it for months and months, you know. There we did, but it was, everything came out looking almost done, you know.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate that. I feel like that's also just from working with Neil. I've worked with him for a number of years, and we sent him cuts along the way as they're shooting in production. But when we were putting the editor's cut together, Neil just likes to see what we think is going to work best. He wants to see your interpretation. He wants to see what you think will work best, and use that as a starting point. And so we put a lot of emphasis on that throughout the entire film.
When the Academy gets down to the final five racers, there's a spoken intro. Maybe it's Orlando Bloom's character is like describing what's going to happen. And you're actually seeing it happen as he's describing it. Was it cut for him to be on camera for that? Or was it designed for him to kind of be voiceover through that section?
In the script, it's broken up with scenes. We embellished that and took it a lot further, sort of took that idea and ran with it. I was a big fan of NFL films growing up, so they use a lot of voiceover and then slam in the action underneath the voice. So I've always learned that when you have a voiceover like that, you can get away with anything. And then the final thing is, I also have a background sort of in documentaries and commercials, and we call that CSAY, where whatever they're saying, we want to see it. And so I kind of adhere to, you know, the CSAY gods as well when we have something like that, and try and find things, whether it's a reach or not, that line up with what the VO is saying.
We talked a little bit about the close-up shots, some of that kind of B-roll type footage that you used in some of those burst cuts. This is geeky, but were they inside or outside of scene bins? Like, did you just have a bin of, here's a bunch of stuff from the inside of the engine, whether it was VFX or real, here's gear shifts, here's pedals on the floor, here's, you know, brakes hitting, whatever.
They were organized as separate bins. And actually, our visual effects supervisor, Victor Muller, who's incredible, he shot all those on set. But they're very specific to the car that they're that Jan was driving, like the GTR cars, and then there's an LMP2. So it was just trying to keep track of this steering wheel and this foot pedal is meant for this driver and this car. But we had bins of that. And then I just went through the scenes I was working on and made select reels of those moments.
The mechanical inserts that you're talking about too, that where it looks like they've bisected a part of a motor or whatever, I think they actually did that. Like, they had to take the engines apart, and they had this huge bin of that was sort of, I don't think it had a specific intention, so we kind of used it in lots of different places in different ways. And then when Neil watched it, I remember at one point he created a sort of dogma for each race. And I don't remember if it ended up being strictly how we adhered to it, but like the first race at the end of the Academy, when he wins, part of the point of it is that they're overwhelmed by the physicality of the real cars as opposed to the video game, and they're getting thrown around by the weight of it. And so he was like, we're going to use a lot of that. And so in that race, we introduced those mechanical shots. For several of the races, we would have, for variety of reasons, a certain rule of what kind of shots. I forget which race it was where he was like, we're going to use these micro drones where the cameras are whipping around the cars in this really dynamic way. So each race has sort of a distinct flavor for a specific reason. And then the finale at Le Mans, it was like everything mixed together. And I thought that was really cool.
I think there's five or six races. And when the first time we presented to Neil, they were still the early versions of the cut. I mean, firstly, they ran long, but also they all just sort of blended into one giant race, you know, sort of like a Phish concert, I imagine, like all the songs sound like. But Neil came in and gave specific rules. He was like, Red Bull, we're not going to use the drones. And so each race, we were disciplined to certain cameras we could use. And then the Le Mans race, which was sort of Austin's baby, that was, all right, the kit and caboodle. When we go back to Le Mans, you can use everything.
It really set up the stakes of like why we were showing that race. This is the point of this race. This is what we're trying to tell the audience and how we're trying to do it. I think Neil wrote an email to us all and just kind of like laid out the important beats and like what we were trying to achieve with these races. I keep thinking about how awesome that was to have and kind of use as a guide when we were building those sequences.
Can any of you talk about how you deal with handheld as an editor, kind of dealing with the camera motion itself almost being performance, or how you get in and out of a handheld shot to something that's more, you know, tripod, dolly driven?
I have no philosophy about it. I just pick the shots that seem cool and then look at it and see if like feels like we're missing anything. I think the overarching like rule for this movie was to try to make it Archie, our protagonist's point of view, as much as possible, especially the handheld stuff where we're tight with him. I think the only rule is basically trying to find the next shot after the shot where you're tight with Archie, the next shot either being literally a point of view shot of what he's looking at or what he's encountering, or something that can, that feels like it. And that was another thing that Neil continuously gave us the note, like it needs to be more from Archie's point of view, more point of view, more point of view. I mean, I think the way that Neil shot it and a lot of his movies are very kinetic, almost looks like war photography. And so it's just kind of innately in the footage. It's not like we're trying to find the cool handheld stuff because there's just so much of it.
That's my feeling from District 9, was that kind of wartime photography feel to it, that it feels authentic to like a documentarian.
We kind of stole a thing from District 9 also where they go to TV camera angles often. It's like unclear, are we watching the movie or the TV show within the movie? And we kind of did that a lot, especially in the racing sequences where we would take a shot that felt appropriate and put TV graphics and an announcer over it. So it's like all of a sudden you're aware that this is a televised event and you're changing perspective, and then you're sucked back into being really intimate with Archie again. I thought that was cool.
He's really known for making things look very verite. He's just so good at that and mixing visual effects in that as well. Like I remember him and Victor, our visual effects supervisor, revising so many shots, especially for like car crashes, because Neil was so particular about it looking real and not making it look too perfect or too Hollywoodized.
There is definitely some kind of cool irony, I think, where almost all of his other work is science fiction visual effects heavy, and then this is a movie where he wanted it to feel as though there are no visual effects.
I love some sound design around the hero character Jan. When he has an idea, like when he's on the racetrack and he sees a new line that he could take, that there's sound design which kind of lets you know he's thinking. Can you talk about that, and did the sound design change the visual cutting?
It's there to elevate, but with all this, you know, gamer vision scenes, I mean, the ultimate goal is to transpose the audience into Jan's head or make us feel like we're sitting next to him. And these were mandates from Neil from the beginning, that he loves hearing these radios, but it's hard to hear and it's hard to actually articulate exactly what we're hearing. And he wanted that experience. There's certain points where we drop out sound just to hear Jan's breathing and really be inside Jan's head. Obviously, to that note, the graphics, the way when he was playing the video game, what it looked like to him. And now we're seeing the video game, but we're being transposed into the race car with him. And it's all about sort of living what Jan's living and what this character's living. And I think that was what Neil's vision was, and it was our job to translate into the film. And so that was definitely a conscious decision. Obviously, an editor's job is to execute and get Neil's vision to the screen. And then, you know, we would obviously embellish it and try to enhance that. Eric had a scene. He was kind of the first guy to really drop the engine and all sounds and hear the breathing. And then Neil reacted well to that. And he was like, let's try that in a few other areas. And I think that's what something I'm really proud of in the film is it does feel like you're in the race car a few times.
There's also a thing I think is pretty great where we called it gamer vision in the edit. Like he's in a real car, but he's using the lessons he learned from the video game. And so we took the way that these like lines are laid out when you play the game and then used the actual Gran Turismo sound effects whenever we could. That turn when he starts racking up going into the end of Le Mans, I get goosebumps. It's so satisfying when he hits those markers and it's like bling, bling, bling. It helps a lot. And it's also really cool for the gamer hardcore audience out there. I hope they appreciated that.
That and during the police chase, because that was inscripted, and that one really does the job well of explaining how he's using this skill to evade the cops and then later, obviously, to do well at Le Mans.
Tell me a little bit about the Tokyo montage. Was that something that was maybe longer scenes and it got shortened down? Was it scripted like that when he goes to Tokyo with his girlfriend?
Yeah, originally that was scripted as scenes. I mean, they shot all this great B-roll of them walking around Tokyo, which is really cool. There's a scene that we took out where they went and did karaoke. It was a cute scene, but it just took a really long time. There was also them at the sushi restaurant, which originally was a much longer scene of some dialogue between the two of them. But at that point in the story, I think we really wanted to feel like that was, you know, a fun date night, but also just start moving things along and find out what happens next with Jan on the track. So we ended up making a montage out of that. But I will say something really cool about the sushi restaurant is the sushi chef. It's a cameo by Kaz, the guy who actually designed Gran Turismo.
Very similar to your line of questioning about the GT Academy montage. Each beat or scene was very long and got conflated into this awesome feeling montage by the end. And to also just tip of the hat to Austin, I remember looking at a cut. They're in the sushi bar and he gives them this sushi. And in the first cut, it just kind of gets glazed over. And I was like, wait, hold on. I'm as a sushi head, they're in Tokyo. And then they're like, it's so good. Give me more. But we never really see the sushi. And Austin went in and found a close up of the sushi being presented.
Eric, that was for you, man. That was, I think you gave me that note when I showed you that cut and you're like, where's the sushi?
Eric gave me that note too and I wasn't working on it. I'm like, I'm not
I'm glad we're talking about it now because that is a make or break shot in the whole movie. But you know, Neil did say that was like one of the top sushi restaurants like in all of Tokyo that they shot at.
So in the Nürburgring thing, I love that you just start right on lap 6. Was it scripted like that? Or did you have laps 1 through 5 and you're like, yeah, we get these all have to go?
It was not scripted in my recollection. And I think just so cool coming in hot like that.
I would say the Red Bull race, which is fantastic that Colby put together. That was really about, you know, him getting into the car, the whole setup, getting rolled out, doing the warm-up lap. And I think by this time in the movie, the audience has already experienced that. So it was time to progress and move away from that.
I called it the Dark Night of the Soul sequence. So something bad happens and things get a little emotional for a bit. Tell me about determining how long you need to be in that segment for it to be effective, for you to know the weight of it, the emotional weight of it, and how long you got to go, we got to get on to the next thing. He can't be sad about this for the rest of the movie. We got to move on.
You know, first you have to give credit to Neil and the actors because he's directing them and they're giving incredible performances throughout. It's a shame all what is on the editing floor because there's tons of great footage and all the actors really went for it. But as editors, we're searching for the most impactful performances to provide an audience with an elevated experience. So the performances speak to you, and then you see what is relatable to you or what you find an audience can relate to and what is believable. I've cut a lot of these scenes within different movies, especially doing a lot of movies based on a true story. I always kind of lean on personal experiences as well. And just, I've cried a lot in my life. So I just fall back on personal experience and what is the most believable and authentic.
To me, it was written pretty close. Those scenes were actually pretty close. And like, they had reckoned with this in the writing. Okay, we know we're, this has to happen. The hero must be challenged. It really happened. So we cut each of the beats on its own. When the bad thing actually happens and right afterwards in that mayhem, I think Austin cut that scene. And it's like one of the only bits of the movie where there's no dialogue at all for a couple minutes, maybe. I don't know how long that scene is. And I think that was very effective. Like, it works really well. And you stop down the pace of the storytelling for a couple of minutes to let it wash over you. And also, I think really important to do it right. And I think it worked really well.
First time reading the script, when that happened, I was like blown away. I was like, there's no way this happened in real life. And then I did, the research afterward online, and I looked up, and not to give away too much, but I saw a horrific video, I think somewhere still on YouTube, being respectful of that.
The parents are at the beginning of the movie, and they're pretty strongly at the end of the movie, but there's a middle of the movie, they're kind of gone. Were they there in the script? Did you feel like you needed to keep them alive in some way? For example, in that Dark Night of the Soul, the parents are in that section, and it's pretty powerful that they're there.
There was a scene that we cut out after the Tokyo sequence. He went back home and met his parents for dinner and kind of explained that he got a contract with Nissan, and we cut it. And I cut the scene a few times, and it just ended up slowing down the movie when we needed to progress.
You already know he's got the contract, right?
You already know he's got the contract. You know that his dad isn't very supportive of him. And so to just move the story along, that was just one of the things that didn't end up in the final film. And I think it was a good move. The story moves along great. That scene that you're just talking about when he's talking to his mom on the iPhone, that was a moment where we could understand their side of things. I will say the parents were great. Jan's dad specifically was fantastic. Colby cut the most emotional scene with Jan's dad, with Jaimin and Archie in the trailer before Le Mans at the very end.
Oh, yeah. I figured that's the one we were talking about.
That's where my daddy issues came in handy.
You know, that there's something to that, right? Let me just talk about the daddy issues. It doesn't have to be daddy issues, but I was actually just listening to James Cameron talking about the lived life of a filmmaker and how important that is. You know, that you can know how to run an Avid or Premiere, you can know how to run a Red camera, but what really makes you a filmmaker is that you have lived a life, know people, find people interesting. Talk to me a little bit about that, the value of your life experiences when you get into the editing room.
Pete Berg literally had said that sentence to me. He's like, I like you, Cole, because you're not some nerd. It looks like you've done LSD a few times in your life. It's like, okay. You kind of have to get out the room and live life and be able to relate to these different scenarios. You know, we're storytellers, so we have to be able to inject parts of our lives and our experiences into our editing, which we all do. And, you know, from working with these two guys, and we definitely screen the movie every Friday more than I've ever done on any other film, but we would screen it and we would give each other notes and then attack those notes and address them. And we wouldn't just say, do this. We'd articulate why and give everything a purpose story-wise. And this is going to advance the story. This is for character. Both Austin and Eric, I consider very methodical editors, fantastic editors. And they would actually put me in check a lot of times. And this is what we need for the story. We need more character here. You know, I would be like, let's one more burst cut. And, you know, they would be like, we need some more character as well. So that's what I would say on the subject.
I think it's really true in everything in life, but especially in making something creative, making art. I always say, no matter what I'm doing, I have to fall in love with it. You know, like years ago, I caught a Lady Gaga documentary, and I was like, for a couple months, I was huge into Lady Gaga, and her story and her hero's journey moved me, and it still does. And you just have to really do that with all these characters. All three of us played sports in our youth. It was very easy for me to like relate to Archie and his journey. So it's kind of like my editing journey and learning a bunch of technical skill, but you also have to trust your instincts. And it wasn't hard for me to relate to that. I agree with everything that Austin said about the father-son relationship, which is sort of the core of it. We had versions of the cut where in the first act, dad was kind of just a dick. Everything he said was, you'll never amount to anything if you keep chasing your crazy dreams. And then we sort of pulled it back, and Neil gave that note several times where you felt the love of the dad and you understood that he was doing this not just because he's a curmudgeon, which I think like those little nuances are like the difference between this feeling like a good movie and an after school special. And there's a couple of beats along the way. There's a scene where I think it's when we meet the dad. I forget if it's the first time we meet dad, but when they're sitting at the dinner table, I think Austin cut that scene, that, and it feels really important in the end. That's the scene that sets up all of the emotional payoff. And there's like exposition that's helping us understand our character and the journey. I think it's like very well written and acted and directed, and like it all plays out really, really beautifully. And then when they, not to give anything away, but when they hug and cry at the end, it feels really impactful. Like that dinner table conversation was like really subtle. We changed the dialogue here and there and took a line out or a line in, but a lot of nuance to like the reaction on the dad's face that I thought we ended up sort of making him into like a real human being in a way that was, I really liked.
Jaimin is such a good actor. I mean, it really makes anything that we do look good. He's very subtle and but really good. But also, like, talk about the dialogue. That scene originally, there was more exposition, more kind of the same beats that we've learned in a few other scenes with him in the first act. And so it was really finding what parts do we need to learn here without Jan's dad coming across like a total asshole.
I would probably ask Austin, what made him put in this Michael Mann track? Because like I said, I've been asked that about 20 times.
Well, that is Moby. It's not Michael Mann, but it is made famous from the 1994 movie Heat. I did read an IMDb comment that did not appreciate us using that track.
Tarantino can do it, but no one else can, you know, like take existing songs from existing soundtracks.
Neil and I have been working together for a really long time, and a lot of times he'll send me tracks and I'll send him tracks. And for the end of La Molly, I know he wanted something that was a needle drop. I think it was one weekend. He's like, dude, we got to find the right piece of music. And he's also very big into electronic music. So I just started listening to Spotify. I do this a lot when I'm putting scenes together, is I listen to Spotify, find a track that I really like, or that is kind of the right vibe, and then create a radio station off of that. And so I put a playlist together and I sent Neil the playlist. And then he's like, oh, you know, this Moby track is really interesting. Let's try that. And then we put it on to picture and it kind of stuck.
And then they got the price and it went away and then it came back.
Oh yeah. There was a whole issue. It was way too expensive. We couldn't afford it.
Actually, the head of Sony, Tom Rothman, he was like, where's that track? Cause we had taken it out for budgetary reasons. And they're like, oh, it was too expensive. He's like, put it back in. So he did. He was like, that was the emotional punch. We need that. How did he say it, Eric?
He's like, you'll be surprised to hear me say this because people know me as the cheapest guy in town. But I think in this case, it's worth the money. you changed the music, right? I'll put it to you this way. When that scene used to play, I felt something. When we play it without that music, I don't feel it as much anymore.
A good note.
I think a lot of people are curious about that.
There's also no umbrellas at the Brainstorm. Colby always likes that.
I say that all the time. No umbrellas at the Brainstorm. I like that.
Colby, do you remember when towards the end we were trying to figure out, you know, all the songs we could get in, and we had these like spreadsheets, and we were putting together like our top favorites. And I remember Neil was at the coffee bean, and you and I like walked over there to him as like, this is like the priority list. This is what I think we need to fight for.
Yeah, because we actually did censor ourselves on that one. He's like, no, put these songs back in. And we like walked back and gave ourselves a silent high five. We're like, yes, he's going to fight for him. You know?
I want to let you guys enjoy a beautiful Labor Day weekend. So I'm going to, even though I could talk about this for a long time, I'm going to let you go. Thank you all for being on Art of the Cut and having such a great conversation about your movie.
Thank you so much, Steve. And, you know, thanks for flying, you know, the editorial flag and cinematic flag. We all appreciate you.
Steve, I'm a huge fan of your podcast. And like almost every single day on my way to the studio, I was listening to your show, and it kind of like provided some sort of like motivation to get through the day, and it was really inspirational. And I really appreciate everything that you do. Thank you.
I want to ask Austin one last question. What did you think of the switch from Premiere to Avid for this one?
I've worked in Avid periodically throughout my career, but never this much. And you know, I was a firm believer in Premiere beforehand, but then I had help from a friend editor kind of get me prepared when this came about. And then the first couple of weeks, it took me a little bit to transition. But I would say the big thing for me is I just had to like retrain my brain on how to think. They are different. I feel like Premiere is a lot like you just grab and throw things on a timeline, and it's very user friendly in that way. And that's also, it's very elastic and you can just do whatever. And I feel like with Avid, it's more like premeditated your thought process. And so once I kind of just trained my brain to think differently, it was pretty smooth. And I loved my experience with Avid. Obviously, there's like little things that I miss about Premiere, but I would say the same thing about Avid. And I think both are perfectly good platforms. But moving forward, you know, if I get an opportunity to cut another one, I would probably stick with Avid.
That wasn't the answer.
I think of Final Cut 7.
I thought you were going to be like, if I have my druthers, I'll do a film on Premiere.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Have a great day. I really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you on the next one.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Colby Parker Jr., ACE, Austin Daines, and Eric Friedenberg for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hullfish. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.